एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
Hi, I'm Rohan Mirchandani, co-founder at Drums Food International, the owners of Epigamia.
All of us in India are very proud of second-generation Indian-Americans like Kamala Harris, people who have lived up to the Indian work ethic of struggling and rising high. Our guest today is also a second-generation Indian-American who has blazed a trail of his own. He decided to come back to the motherland to build a startup. You may think I'm talking about a tech startup founder here, but today's guest is the founder of one of the toughest businesses in India, an FMCG company. He's introduced hundreds of thousands of Indians to the magic of Greek yogurt. Yes, you guessed it right. Our guest today is Rohan Mirchandani, the founder of Drums Foods, which makes the popular Epigamia Greek yogurt brand. Rohan's conversation with Akshay Dutt is a fascinating insight into how an American navigated the very tough FMCG manufacturing and distribution business in India, and how his hustle and persistence led to the creation of one of the most iconic dairy and plant-based product brands of India.
So, Rohan, first tell me this. How did the Mirchandani clan end up in the US?
My dad came here as an entrepreneur with literally nothing in his pocket. We spent most of our life in Jersey growing up, in New Jersey.
So, like, what did your dad do when he came?
He had a business importing different types of apparel, so clothing, a typical trader trading operation, and some of the vendors were in India and all over. And then back in the early 80s, he had gone to China. And had started, before everyone started doing it, had started sourcing. And then, over time, he got really good at logistics and warehousing and transportation, which were all, the supply chain, which are probably the facet of every business, sort of intrigued him. And he got involved and then, built a logistics and warehousing business, which, gave us a very decent, upbringing when we grew up. So came from literally nothing and then created a lot out of himself here.
So that must have been a pretty inspiring role model in terms of the hustle, the drive to set up your own business. So did you also grow up thinking that you want to set up your own business and, was it like dhanda in the blood, so to say?
Yeah, so it's interesting you ask that because for us, growing up, one thing that we were taught was the value of hard work. So even from the age of 12 or 13, my brother and I used to go and most of our friends in the summer would go to the shore or go to the beach and have fun, and we would be put to work in the warehouse. So we used to go push things around and literally, as I used to joke, slave labor. By my father, but I think it really taught us what hard work meant, and we started to value and really appreciate what that entails. And then I think for me, my brother always had it in him and always has been an entrepreneur, and joining my father, I actually had a different it was never dhanda in the blood, but it was want to be a businessman. And in my career I didn't join the family business. I actually worked outside.
You were the younger one?
I'm actually the older one, believe it or not.
Oh, you're the older one. Okay.
The other way around. Yeah,
I was about to typecast you as the rebel younger.
No, it was the other way around. My brother always worked for the family business. And then over time, my dad, of course, had business partners and it became a very professionally run organization, which it continues to be today. And but my brother always sort of worked there, and I chose a different path. I even my summer internships in college, and when I was, my first job out of college was always, away. But we did try a little stint, where my dad said, "Why don't you come? There's this sort of new division that I'm trying to work on, and I think you'd be good for it." And, I I tried it. You know, the whole thing lasted about 6 months. I think we all realized that, you know, between father and two sons, we'd kill each other. So, okay. So now, but to answer your question earlier, I think, definitely, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, he's more than a mentor. I mean, he's been everything for me. And even though he's probably disagreed with everything I've done in the beginning, you know, I think without his support, and his sort of guidance, there's no chance, you know, I'd be where we are today, or even Drumsuit would be where it is today. So, support was always there. But of course there was always like, are you out of your mind? Are you crazy? You really want to go there and sell dahi? those questions definitely came up. And actually, you know, it's funny because, you know, he's a mentor and he's a father and he's a friend, and you know, it's very rare to have that sort of relationship. But what ends up happening is, you know, you end up getting challenged. And I think, you know, the devil's advocate views that he pushed probably really helped me, definitely helped me in every direction. So, yes, a lot of what we are today and I am today goes to him for sure.
So there's like a 6 year period in after your graduation and before your B school. So you spent like a couple of years at Duff & Phillips, half a year with your dad, and then you went to business school.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty
much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. And like, what did you think that you'd do after the B school? Like, was it to get a better paying job? Was that the goal? Or was it that you wanted to have some time to think and figure out, and B school was a good way to have that time? Or like,
what was absolutely. The plan? So I think I was one of those discovery students. You know, I think so. We have, you know, I always say there's three, and I'm in no way is a proponent of business school. I always say it's not for everybody, and I very much stand by that. In fact, I've discouraged a lot of people, and their parents have gotten upset with me for discouraging them from going to business school. But I still stand by that, not to be a hypocrite because I did it. But I think, you know, the sort of three areas, right? So you've got your career switchers who want to come in and change their careers. You've got the career advancers who want to become MD at the bank or the consulting firm or whatever it is, and they need to go through B school for that to get the stamp. And then I think the third is the discovery, where you're just trying to figure out, you know, not necessarily change careers, but like what's next in life, you know, just explore sort of options, as you rightfully said. And I think I stood in that bucket, you know, and that was my way. The only thing was, right before business school, I had I had sort of invested in this ice cream parlor in India, which is how Drumsuit had actually started. And I'll tell that story, I guess, as well. So right before business school, I had made a trip to India, and this was more of it was completely a social trip. It was for a distant relative's wedding. And this is where I had met people, and I'll talk about that shortly. But and then in business school, you know, I had never had any intention or any connect to, you know, sort of be in India or do business in India. I'd never had any exposure. But it's crazy how things come back full circle, and this sort of side hobby investment is something I pursued as a career. Thanks, I paid a lot of money to business school to tell me this is the career I should pursue.
Okay, so tell me about that first trip to India, and
that
probably wasn't the first trip, I guess.
It wasn't the first trip. My grandparents lived there in Mumbai, and you know, we used to visit, and they used to live with us, so we used to visit every few years. And you know, typical sort of the NRIs that used to come, and now I get annoyed when the NRIs come and eat up our traffic in Mumbai. So and flood the restaurants. You know, hopefully we'll get back to that life soon after this COVID crisis. But such an innocent life, right? Now you think about it, that was. But we used to come back. The typical when there's school, you know, school or college break, and even when we were younger, we used to come. But again, it was, you know, more just for a few weeks or max, you know, 3 weeks, a month, and then come back. But one of the trips I did take was in, you know, right before business school. So I went to B school from 2010 to 2012. In 2009 or so, I had taken a trip, and I had, you know, a really good dear friend of mine who actually was living out in California. So Bombay guy, born and raised in Bombay, and he was living out in California. He had gone to Stanford. And he wanted to come back to India to start something. I actually had a wedding to attend as well. And this is the time when I had just taken my GMATs. I was going to apply for B school. And I said, you know, I'm going to come out there anyways. Let me spend some time with him and catch up and see what he's up to. And he had this idea to do this sort of, you know, tech venture. And without going into too much detail, you know, I sort of pursued that with him for, we talked about it for a little bit. I had some calls before I went out to India. Then when I went out to India, I met him. And then I also, of course, like I said, I had to attend a distant relative's wedding. And then during that time, the two of us, during the research for that venture, we met, you know, this local chef in India, Chef Ganesh, who was one of my co-founders. And, you know, he sort of had this idea to do an ice cream parlor or an ice cream lounge, as we called it. And, you know, it was like a great meeting of minds, and me being a big food person and, you know, fashion is food across the board. Anyone you talk to, will tell you. We just thought we'd, you know, something fun and cool to invest in. And honestly, we had no clue what we were doing. And there was no business plan. There was no unit economics. There was nothing thought through. It was just, you know, it was something that it was passion driven. It wasn't a significant amount of money when we started it. It was just a few of us. And we just all, you know, so my friend Milap, who I mentioned from Stanford, myself, Uday, who's another one of my co-founders, and then Chef, we all just pitched in some money, and Chef set this thing up, and we hired, you know, a local Pizza Hut manager to run it. And that was just a, like I said, purely passion driven. And this was, I guess, part of my discovery, what I want to do. And I said, okay, this will be something nice on the side, and then I'll go to business school. And that's how that whole thing sort of started. That's how Drum Suit actually came to be.
How much stake did you have at that time? Like, how you must have been a very minority stakeholder.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers, but we were equally distributed at that time. I mean, because everyone had sort of put something. And then, of course, over time, you know, when I decided to put, you know, when I decided to do this full time and put more money behind it for myself than whatever I had saved, and then of course I took on a lot more shareholding.
Okay. So how did this? Like a hobby investment become your full-time gig?
Yeah, the big shift in life, career shift. So I as I mentioned, so, you know, I invested in this, and then I went to B school, and the idea was to sort of discover what to do next. And honestly, I had gone with a very open mind, you know, starting from, to be very true to that, you know, I didn't think I was going to start something of my own, but I had met some very cool people in business school, and we talked about potentially, you know, working with them and starting something up. All those, everyone who goes to some business school or even undergrad, I guess, always has that conversation with their buddies. But I, you know, this venture was a little different because it was remote. I was all the way across in here, and at that time in Philadelphia, and then this was in India and Mumbai and whatnot. And I actually came in December of 2011. I remember very clearly. So it's almost 9 years ago. I had taken a class through business school in India. It was called Marketing to the Indian Consumer. So, you know, we had all these modular courses at business school where you could go to.
You had like an exchange program with an Indian B school.
It wasn't an exchange program. It was like a week-long immersion program. It was more of an immersion. So you would come during your break, and you'd get half a credit for the class. And what you would do, and it was one of our renowned professors, Professor Jagmohan Raju, who teaches marketing. And it was like a week-long course. And then they had it in different countries, you know, all over Brazil, China. I took one in India, one in South Africa. And it's just a great way to sort of go around, meet business leaders, you know, and things of that nature. And it's, you know, and of course, you know, some of the most amazing guest lecturers that came in. And I was always intrigued by I wasn't a marketeer by profession. I was a finance guy, but marketing always was core to my heart. I always loved it. I always enjoyed it. I just didn't understand it. And then when I took this class, you know, we had two amazing guest lecturers. One of them was Damodar Mal, who is now the CEO of Reliance Retail, as everyone knows. And the other one was Shripad Nadkarni, who used to be the CMO of Coca-Cola India, and then started a consulting practice called MarketGate, sold it, and then started investing in startups, and then actually ended up doing it as his own investment, his own startup called Mavericks Platforms, which has been around for some time, for 2-3 years now. So, and both these guys sort of talked about the consumer. And again, mind you, this is December 2011, when probably was not the most exciting time to be there. You know, we were at the height of the scandals in the central government. There was the, you know, 2G scandal and coal and all that other stuff going on. But I, you know, I think both of them talked about the advent of consumerism and what the coming decade would bring, or the coming decade would do, and then what would happen in the 20, 30, 40 years to come. And Shripad especially, you know, really talked about, you know, seeing, you know, that when you go to a a store, a food store. So whether it's a kirana shop or a grocery store. And at that time, to be honest, modern trade hadn't even started yet. It was just about to start in 2011. And said, you know, when you go to these stores, you can literally count on your fingers all the companies that own these brands, you know, whatever they are. And you know, said, and the other thing that I remember him very clearly saying is that in the next decade or two, we will see brands that are created that will stand the test of time. And, you know, I think that was sort of the eureka, or as they say, the ghanti baj gayi moment that I had in that class. And, you know, as usual, the class ends and, you know, all the students bombard the guest lecturer. So I got in the queue. I got his business card. And then I stayed in touch with him. I reached out to him. And then I don't know, just something struck me. I had that, you know, feeling that there was a calling here, you know, what he just said. I've got this small ice cream parlor. Sure, we haven't done anything with it and it's not making any money. And all we're really doing is paying rent to the landlord. But that's not the point. The point is that, you know, there's this opportunity to create a brand. And for me, it just became more about what he said, where, you know, creating a brand or a name that could be around for much longer than you are on planet Earth, right? And I think that really, really, you know, spoke to me, and that sort of really drove me. So I stayed in touch with Shripad. He had just started to sell his company to the Publicis Group, which he did at that time, and he had just invested in another startup, his first startup investment, which was Hector Beverages Paper Boat. You may have heard of them. That was his first investment, who also in the original, so a dear friend now, happens to be a Wharton grad as well, 2 years my senior. And then ended up sort of, being in touch. I actually went to India again just to meet with him, because I asked him on a call, you know, from here, from the United States, that could you help out with this? And honestly, at that point, I was still like 50-50. I knew I wanted to do something with this. I didn't know what it was. I thought maybe I'll get him to help, you know, advise or consult or invest, and we could create something. And it was always a finance hat thinking, right? Oh, we could go and raise some money and hire a CEO and all this other stuff. That was always the initial thought, because, you know, it was a side hobby investment. So I had a call with him and he said, look, why don't you come to India and spend some time with me? So I did. And we spent some days together, and he said that, look, I'm going to give you, I think what you're doing is really exciting. There's something massive to be done here. There's an amazing opportunity. But I've got two conditions that I'm willing to work. He said, I'm not going to be a consultant because my fees are way too expensive. You won't be able to afford them. But I'll work with you under two conditions. And the first condition was that he would invest in the company and have equity as an angel. It was very clear that if I don't have equity, I'm not interested. And the second was that I had to move from the US to India and do this full time. I couldn't just get a job in New York and then do this on the weekends and, you know, half in, half out. And so I told him, look, I need some time. Let me think this one through. So this was in 2012.
One clarification here. So this was for an ice cream parlor, like a chain of ice cream parlors, or for an ice cream brand?
No, so the idea wasn't about ice cream parlors. The idea was to create a fresh FMCG brand that would focus on fresh food, cold chain driven food. So without getting into too much nuances, but then the idea was to convert this into FMCG. So FMCG was always the play. That was the idea. The idea was to convert it into FMCG and then do a plethora of products. But yes, the initial product line was ice cream, to answer your question. And we'd always talked about doing other products, which I'll get to as well in my story. For us, the way we looked at it was, as I mentioned, you know, this parlor was not making any money. It was just, to be candid, probably the worst business one can get into. You can work as hard as you want, but at the end of the day, the economics always favor the landlord. And we've seen it. I mean, we haven't seen anyone sort of, unless now with, you know, the last few years, we had the malls come up and do rental revenue shares, and you've got these big global brands coming in. But to create that business from scratch was a really tough one. I mean, we're still seeing so many, you know, QSR companies struggle to figure that model out. And especially in ice cream, when you're, you know, it's a dessert. You know, people don't come for lunch or for that matter, breakfast, to eat ice cream. So you have to pay rent 24 hours, but your sales are only happening at that finite time, after, you know, let's say 9 p.m. to midnight. So, and your landlord doesn't care. I can't tell my landlord, boss, I'm just going to pay you between 9 and midnight. You know, you divide my rent for 24 hours. Yeah. I have to pay him for the month. And it was just not an easy business. And, you know, I know a lot of people have tried and we got into some other areas. But anyway, long story short, it was a very tough sort of hole. But, you know, there was a calling that spoke to me, and the calling was FMCG to convert this and seeing scale there. And again, now, of course,
so when Sripad told you had to like move to India, was that like a easy decision to convince your family on, and
not at all
face a pushback?
Not at all. So, I mean, that was going to be my next thing. So pushback was crazy. I mean, I never said yes to them. I said, give me some time. And I spent about 6 months going back and forth between I graduated in May or June 2012, around that time. And I think it was May. And then I spent about 6 months going back and forth, you know, really sort of seeing, is this an opportunity I want to pursue? Is this something worth doing? And just, you know, seeing what it was, and then trying to talk to everybody I knew, including my family. And everyone said, you're literally out of your mind. I mean, this is insanity, you know, to go, first of all, you went to this business school, you got a nice degree, and now you want to go and run a small little ice cream parlor. and that to a one that's not making any money, and you're trying to figure out, a food, you've no career in food, you've never had anything in food, you've never worked in India in your life, you've never been in, you've no idea what entrepreneurship means. So now you want to check the boxes on everything, you know. So normally you see a lot of folks that have some functional expertise and then, you know, reach out and become entrepreneurs there. I had nothing. I had zero on everything, which I, you know, continue to in some sense, I do, I guess. But I think one thing that I did have, which was always there, was passion. I mean, it was very clear that this is something that I wanted to pursue, and I wanted to pursue it for myself. You know, I think everyone sort of tries to convince themselves they're doing it for other reasons. You know, I think that my sort of take to any entrepreneur listening to this, or any, you know, soon to be entrepreneur, just remember it's always for yourself. It always will be, you know, it's not for anyone else. Yes, you make your family happy and they'll be proud and all that is there, but remember you're doing it for yourself. And therefore it's not just that, it's the sacrifices that everyone makes, you know, your family makes, my wife, of course, I didn't mention I was married. So I got married in that journey. And then, you know, just to convince
her, while you were at Wharton, you got married?
Right before business school. And then, while I was at Wharton, in fact, I was at Wharton and she was studying at NYU getting her master's. So we were playing sort of different cities. And then convincing her then to come to India was probably the toughest investor I got to invest. that was a tough one. Okay. And then, of course, the story was always, it'll be 3 years, and then 3 years became 4 years, 4 years became 5 years. And then, you know, that kept going. But kudos to her, because I think without her, this would not have been possible either. And then coming back to what you said, it was friends, family, my father and his friends that just sort of didn't see the nuance here. Like, what is it that, you know, and again, you know, when you say to someone, my business plan is to create a brand, it's very hard for anyone to understand or digest. You know, and I think that that's what, I guess the harder it is for someone to digest, the more excited one should be about doing it. And that's what sort of led me. So I then took me 6 months, and then against pretty much everyone's advice, January 2013. So it's now been 8 years. 8 years ago, I took a one-way ticket and I moved to India.
Mm-hmm, okay. So you land up in India, and there is an ice cream parlor which you are running. So how does that morph into an FMCG company?
Yeah. So I land up in India. There's an ice cream parlor, which is, let's repeat, not making any money. The unit economics are horrible. I have zero experience in doing any of this. And I think the first thing for me was to really understand and spend time on the ground as to what's really happening. And for me, when I say what's really happening, is before we start thinking through the operational side of the business or the operating model, I think the idea is, where is this demand going to come from, and what is this demand? So, of course, we had very nice, fancy macroeconomic papers that I read while I was sitting in business school half a world away. But frankly, that's, you know, it's nice to read one of those things, and maybe it gives you some convincing, but that means jack when you come on the ground. That means nothing. You get that sorted out, right? You can read all the reports from all the big banks and the consulting firms, and honestly, that means nothing unless you're on the ground trying to figure things out. So my first few months, I actually just sat at the ice cream parlor. I served ice cream. And I think, you know, frankly, till date, I would say, you know, a lot of people tell me, oh, you've got a good insight into the Indian mindset and how, you know, the consumer thinks. And I say, sure I may, but whatever I know today is credited to those few months I spent in that ice cream parlor selling ice cream. You know, literally sitting there scooping, serving, and then having tons and tons of conversations, just talking to people. Why do you select chocolate? Why did you prefer mango? You chose chocolate last week. Why did you choose mango now? You always have chocolate. Why did you choose vanilla today? And just understanding the different, you know, psyches, right? There's, and you know, and like I said, it's one thing to read in the newspaper or a blog, but it's a whole different thing to speak to live consumers in front of you, who are actually taking out rupees in their wallet and paying you for it, for products. And that's where the first nuance that really hit was, you know, that there was this fundamental shift, and I'm talking about 2013 now, towards healthier lifestyle eating. I remember even in those few months, I remember some of those clients that literally used to come in every single night. We had a parlor in Bandra. Every single night, I found a few, you know, few months later had stopped coming because they were trying to lead more balanced or coming a lot less frequently. And that's when I realized that there was this sort of fundamental play in more lifestyle-based, healthier eating. And I say healthier very carefully, you know, because I think health is very much defined. Every individual has different needs and everyone individual. And science is proving more and more that health is not a one-size-fits-all type glove. You know, I think it's really dependent on your body type or your genetics or whatever it is. But I realized that healthier products were something that we were seeing are more and more in demand. And that's really was the first footprint was to come there. And then the second footprint was to look at, you know, moving and trying to leverage whatever little goodwill we had created with the parlors, the social media following we had, et cetera, and then convert it into an FMCG play. And that was sort of the second footprint. And there was a lot of times during that first, I would say the first 3 years, but the first year was the toughest, just sort of banging your head against the wall and saying, what is wrong with you? What are you thinking? You know, we had our office was behind a CNG pump in Kurla on LBS Marg in Bombay, for those of you who are from Bombay. And it was literally, it wasn't even an office. It was, we had our kitchen downstairs, you know, 1,000 square feet where we made ice cream. And above it, we had created a mezzanine where anyone above five feet tall would have to literally duck their head. And only when you were seated could you actually put your head up. And we were there for a very long time, and we were there till 2016. So 3 years we spent there until we raised some money. That was our office. And, you know, a lot of times when things are going well, you're happy and excited and you can live with it. But when things are not going well, you think to yourself, what am I doing here? I mean, I have to, you know, do squats to get inside my office every day. is that what I want to do, you know, for the rest of the 3 years? But those were fun times now that we look back.
Mm-hmm. So you did the manufacturing all in-house, like you didn't like go to a contract manufacturer?
Well, in the beginning, because it was just downstairs. So in the beginning, it was all done in-house. And then I actually remember in 2015, when we had a, was it 2000? No, it was 2014, actually. I think 2015, sorry. 2015 was the same year we launched Epigamia. Earlier that year, we had done a deal with Reliance Fresh, to sell ice cream. And we'd done a whole gamification drive with them where we'd gone to all their locations across the country, especially in the major cities, and done this gamified deal where if consumers bought XYZ, they would get some off and discounts and stuff like that. And I remember doing that, and we sold out in like 2 days what we had projected for like a 10-day campaign. And I remember that's when we said, all right, boss, this is not the little leagues anymore. We need to sort of step it up. And that's when we decided to move out of there and then start working with a co-packer at that point. So the first 2 years was all in-house, was all done ourselves.
When did packaged ice cream get launched, like as a product available on shelves?
14 was packaged ice cream, and then 15.
And how did you get it on the shelves?
Oh, so two things. So one was, you know, as I mentioned, we when I first moved there, we were able to get Shripad to come in as an angel investor. And then we had my professor, one of my friends, professors from NYU came in, and we got some really interesting folks. And then through them, we were able to get some introductions to some of these modern trade guys. And you know, I love telling everyone this story because I've been advising entrepreneurs now the last few years. We just got royally ripped off by modern trade. I won't take names. But you know, and I realized that I thought we were so excited. Oh, they gave us space, but they just wanted us to pay the listing fees. So, you know, we paid up. I mean, and therefore we could only start a few locations because they wanted listing fees for each location. But whatever little capital we raised, we put towards that. And then the other way was the good old fashioned way of going door to door, getting down on our knees and folding our hands and saying, Saab, Madhav. And I personally did that. I've gone to many Kirana shops. Rahul, my co-founder, my other co-founder came later. And I think that, I think just the resilience of us and the team and just literally begging. And even when we started, I mean, I remember, there was Neelam Foodland in Bombay. There was a couple of stores, my home Super Shoppy in Malad. There was another store in Kandivali. I remember these are some of the first stores we started. And they thought we were just the craziest bunch of people they've ever seen in their lives.
Yeah, they must have been wondering, who's this American-sounding guy who's selling ice cream in India?
And sitting, and din mein do tub dikhte hain ice cream ke, and this guy is like, he's lost it when two tubs of ice cream sell. And that was a fun one. I remember there was My Home Super Shoppy in Malad, and I used to go there in the beginning a lot. One of the first places that agreed to keep our ice cream, that itself was a big deal. And then I remember, on the shelf, he had a small chiller in the corner. It wasn't even a shelf. It was like a small chiller freezer in the corner. And over there, he had Quality. He had Amul. He had, I'll tell you right now, Quality, Amul, Havmor, and us. These are the four ice creams he had. And I remember him keeping, and literally we, in that chest, you must have had, I don't know, 70, 80 tubs of different brands. And we probably had just 5 tubs kept there. So if you think about it, and 5 times 200. So even if we sold out in a day, which wasn't possible, it was 1,000 rupees of sale, right? And for this, even though he's a Kirana shop, okay, that's nice. But he's like, this mad fellow is sitting here all day long. Just what is wrong with him? He's like a creep. Anyone coming into the shop, he's looking at them. He's trying to figure out, and anytime anyone would walk towards that freezer, I would just run up there and jump and start having a conversation. So at one point, the guy there was very cool, the boy who ran the shop, but his boss, who was the main owner, he kind of got annoyed and said, okay, we don't want you here every day. You're scaring our customers. Because for me, the fact that they were going, I just wanted to have conversations. I wanted to know why do you eat ice cream?
This is part of your on-ground research.
Absolutely. And well, at this point, it had gone beyond research. It was actually trying to validate assumptions at this point. So there were assumptions that we had made based on the research and certain pockets we wanted to place the products.
What were those assumptions?
So there were different types of stores we had placed in. And there were different stores. So there were different formats. So there was a modern trade format. There was the, like I said, we call it sort of the higher end GT, general trade shop, a GT shop, and then a Kirana shop. So across the four, so for example, in modern trade, we had put promoters who would sit there and make people sample, and they would sample and they would see, and then they would taste and then they'd go away. In Kirana's, it was a little harder to sample because there's not much space to sample. So here it was more about what kind of visibility we would need and what the core message should be that would excite the consumers. So this idea of, freshly made, homemade, Indian made ice cream. Yet we also had very innovative flavors. So the idea was that we were doing things that no one else was. We didn't have the plain chocolate vanilla flavors. We had things like double chocolate therapy, which was like a funky creation. So we were coined by one of the blogs, India's answer to Ben & Jerry's. So there was a lot of assumptions like that we wanted to test and for us, it was just a massive dessert experience in an ice cream tub. It wasn't just, a chocolate or a vanilla ice cream. And these were things that we wanted to ask people and talk to them about. And then, of course, at that time, there were also a lot of thoughts in our head about how this, one of the thoughts was, do we go into, because a lot of the feedback was people are eating healthier, or at least from a permissibility perspective, thinking they're eating healthier or wanting to eat healthier. And the idea was, do we take ice cream into a healthier avatar, or, you know, as our second innings taught us, was Greek yogurt, which took us to the next level. And that's where all of this work on the ground is where most of these insights ended up coming from, and then, you know, took us in that direction.
So 2015 is when you launched Greek yogurt, right?
Right. Correct. In June. That year.
So what was like your top line by that time? Like the year 14, 15, which ended, how much did you do?
No, I'm trying to think. We were probably at a 6 or 7 crore run rate. So maybe 50, 60 lakhs a month, I would say.
And this was like largely from metro cities.
This was mainly metros. It was, I think it was just Bombay, Delhi, Bangalore, honestly, at that time. In Bangalore, I think we had just started. So.
Okay. So then how did Greek yogurt come into the picture?
So the idea was, there was twofold. One was from launching FMCG in 2014, we learned that, and again, these are your highs and lows. So we had this sort of period in, you know, the peak season, which is basically between March and June for ice cream, which is a very seasonal product. You know, we had a great sort of run. It was our first time with FMCG, and we just thought we were kings of the world. Like we literally thought we were unstoppable. We'd become invincible, you know, from all the madness that we had of learning and how the bad the ice cream parlors were to, you know, running those cold chain trucks to the office.
Did you shut down the parlors, or they were...
At that point, we still had them, but then we shut them down later on, of course. You know, you're
okay.
And we saw in that, you know, literally from May, June to July, August, the sales just got desecrated because, you know, seasonality, especially when monsoon comes in, there's always this fear that, you know, my throat's going to get spoiled. You know, gala kharab ho jayega. And that's when we realized that there was, you know, and it was always there was always a vision to do more products. It was never going to be a single product play. And one of my favorite products, you know, when I was in college, and, you know, that came actually was born when I was in college, undergrad, was Greek yogurt. And, you know, and Greek yogurt in some sense is a you know, it is in the cousin relative space to an ice cream, right? It's sort of dairy and flavors and things like that. And one of the things we found was that, you know, this was a space that some large guys had sort of attempted, but they just hadn't really figured out the taste and the permissibility angle. How to sort of play it. At least that's what we had felt. Those were our assumptions that we'd made. And the first season when we saw ice cream sales really dip, you know, we said, okay, this is something. And we actually spoke to a lot of ice cream brands and companies and spoke to people. And we even found that some of the larger ice cream players hire folks just during season. And then in the off season, they let them go. You know, they have like a people they keep on their rolls just for that time period. And then we said, okay, that's not, I mean, how do we do that? I mean, we're a startup. You know, so initially the projection that we wanted to achieve in 4 or 5 years was we could get there, but it's going to take us 10 years. And on top of that, you're trying to build distribution. As I mentioned to you, you're going on your knees and begging these guys to put you on the shelves. And even if they give you a chance, they tell you, abhi nahi season mein aao. You know, and that means you have this very finite period of time when you have to build your distribution and do your sales. And it was just not very feasible. And of course, you know, the digital sort of e-com disruption that we've seen the last 8-9 months was not there back then. Very different way of building businesses from scratch, the old school way. So the way we sort of went about it was we looked at a few different products that we wanted to look at, and Greek yogurt, as I said, was always there. And my co-founder Chef, you know, he had a good idea. He's been trained in sort of gelato making and ice cream making, and he, you know, there were a lot of similarities in terms of the sourcing of ingredients, right? So using really good quality mangoes and strawberries, and then just but coming up with an innovative process to sort of handmade Greek yogurt, which took him some time. And honestly, when we launched it, you know, and this is sort of, I think every entrepreneur, I think, has this story as well. You know, we did it with the intent that it would complement the ice cream business. Never in our lives would we have ever thought that this was going to be just go to the next level and scale the way it did, and would just overconsume us to the extent where we had to sort of let Hokey Pokey go. Even though I don't know if you know, we actually brought Hokey Pokey back a few weeks ago after years, thanks to our direct-to-consumer channel. But that's where the culmination came from. And also I think all the learnings on the ground, the learnings from the ice cream parlors up until this point, we still had the ice cream parlors. So Epigamia was actually first launched in the ice cream parlors as well. And a lot of it was to those consumers. We actually reached out to those consumers that stopped coming or were coming less frequently, because they were leading this quote-unquote healthier lifestyle. And we started getting them to give us feedback and see where we took it from there. And then, you know, I think as an entrepreneur, you keep throwing darts, and the second dart we lined up perfectly.
So initially you would have, like, in your parlors, you would have had a tub where you would scoop out and serve it. Like, that was how you started?
With the Greek yogurt?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we actually had, it wasn't scooping, we had packs. So you would, you know, you open the pack, pour it, and then serve it. And in the initial days, we even used to do some parfaits and muesli and things of that nature. But the idea was to just get people to try and like it. A lot of sampling happened at the parlors. A lot of sampling.
And you also then rolled it out to your FMCG distribution channel.
And then immediately went into FMCG distribution.
So, like, how much did that year end at? Like, you did 6 crores the previous year. So, like, you know, what was the growth you saw because of Epigamia?
If I'm not mistaken, so don't quote me. I don't have my audited financials in front of me, but
that's okay. Like, roughly,
yeah, 20 crores was the second that year after that. So we tripled.
Amazing. Up. So wow, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, that was a big growth surge there for us. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. How did you cope with it? Like, a 3x jump in top line is like means massive logistics to deliver the product.
Yeah, no, it was a hair pulling experience. So one of the big things that happened during just right before this time period was, you know, so Chef will tell you that when I moved to India in January 2013, I brainwashed him to join full time. So he joined later that year, and he took over. And then Uday was there too, and I convinced him to join. And so Uday sort of took over the compliance and the legal angles, whereas, you know, Chef took care of production and operations and R&D, and then I took care of all, you know, sales, marketing, finance. That's how we sort of split the roles. And, you know, more and more we realized that Chef had to really just take care of production and R&D, nothing else. And then operations started coming to me, and I realized, you know, then, I mean, there was no such thing as sleep. That those 2-3 years, it didn't exist. I mean, you slept when you could. It wasn't like, you know, there was no. And then, you know, I started getting really friendly. So we had this Thai group, you know, the TIE in Mumbai. It was a food
business entrepreneur or something like that. Huh?
There was the food committee or a food group that was created with them, and you know, food entrepreneurship. And there was this group that we started calling ourselves the foodpreneurs, and you know, got friendly with some of these guys, all sort of starting off their journey at the same time. You know, so there was Chef's Basket and Baker's Dozen and Raw Pressery, you know, a whole bunch of all Mumbai-based guys. And one of the guys was Rahul Jain, who had started Dr. Moo Organic Milk. And, you know, Rahul and I just, I guess the first, you know, one or two times we met, we just really hit it off. We just you know, sort of love at first sight, bromance, as they call it. and you know, Rahul came also from a finance background. He's from Delhi, born and raised, and then had gone to ISB and started this organic milk startup, and very similar issues, right? We would complain and cry about the same issues every time we'd meet. And part of their plan was to go from organic fresh milk into value-added dairy products. And, you know, and we would actually run ideas by each other. One day he told me what, you know, they were thinking was to get into Greek yogurt. And I said, dude, we're doing Greek yogurt as well. I'm just letting you know, very clearly. And I think it was like the next day or 2 days later, I just called him up and I was like, literally, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. and then he joined. So he joined and he became a co-founder. And that actually really helped us go to the next level, because it allowed me to focus. And, you know, and his sort of experience and expertise is just completely different from mine. I mean, he's much more of a pragmatic, you know, operations person, whereas I'm more off the charts, you know, I'm always staring up into the sky. And I think we balance each other out really well. And so to answer your question, that a lot of the trifold, threefold growth came that year because of having some structure now to the sort of founding team.
So Rahul took care of the production? Like,
No. He was logistics and operations and sales. Marketing and finance came to me, and then Chef was R&D and production.
So you started this as like handmade, but like how long before you realized that it could, like, you know, it needed to be done in a plant, and like how did that scale up happen, like in terms of building your?
Yeah, so we still do it in a sort of handmade format. In some sense, we've done some scale up, and because our yogurt has zero preservatives, is freshly made, and it has a very low shelf life. It's only 14 days, and it has, and that too, if it's kept in perfect cold chain, which in the conditions in India are not conducive. So in the beginning, we had a lot of problems because a lot of the kirana shops would turn their fridge off at night. You know, some of the cold chain distributors we used would also do the same thing, would not have hygiene and integrity. And, you know, and consumers would get really, really upset. Even today, we get complaints every now and then. But back then it was bad because consumers, you know, they're not going to point fingers at anyone else. They're going to point fingers at you because you're the one who made the product. But over time, I think we realized a couple of things. One is that we had to own our own cold chain. So in a city like Mumbai today, we're probably independent distribution wise. We're probably one of the largest independent distributors, just because we built because we built our own cold chain. We have the same thing in the major four or five cities in the country. And we realized we had to do this, to protect the brand and also to expand the business because no one else was ready to do this at such a, today, of course, there's a dime a dozen distributors who want our business, but we're not really, you know, interested because now we've reached some scale. So those margins are healthier with us doing it ourselves. So we in fact chose not to produce ourselves, but to distribute ourselves. So we took that. Those are the decisions that we took. And even now, we haven't gone to some, you know, very industrialized methods of production for Greek yogurt, which are used globally. We still use some indigenous sort of ways of making it. We naturally strain, you know, think almost like a hygienic way of using like a cheesecloth and, you know, straining and making a cheese or chakka or hung curd as they do in the north. So we still follow some, of course, we've, you know, really taken up the, stepped up our game and made it very hygienic and things of that nature. That's still how we make our product. And our product is still very sensitive. So even now, you know, sometimes we're very clear with our consumers, if the cup is a little bit of puffed or something, just let us know immediately and we'll send replacements. Because at somewhere along that cold chain, while the country is getting better and better, in fact, we have a huge test for cold chain coming up with the vaccines. So let's see what happens. But as the country gets better and better, but we're still not there yet.
Mm-hmm. So did you also need external funding for this 3x growth?
That year,
like in 2015, or like when did you had an angel round initially, like in 12-13. So after that, like when did you need funding?
No, so that number I talked to you about was 16-17 that we did, and then 15-16 was I think the 6-7, and then the 16-17 was that number, and then we raised our series A in 2016.
Okay, so just around the time you launched.
Yeah. So we were in the middle of our, in fact, our Epigamia was only a couple of months old when we raised Series A.
And how did the Series A happen? Like, who were the investors who backed you in?
So we had DSG Consumer Partners, DSG CP, Deepak Chaudhary, and Verl Invest. Verl Invest is a institution, it's a fund out of Belgium.
Okay. So, but like, was it a difficult journey to convince people to invest in a curd brand or
I think
a yogurt?
You know, so we obviously had many conversations the prior year. And I think, you know, back when we were raising capital, this was not a sector of, you know, sort of priority or something that, it was always tech. And you know, there wasn't much options. We were sort of restricted. I think the last few years we've seen a lot of funds, you know, open up and start investing in this space, especially now that this, you know, sort of FMCG and tech is also now, you know, combined and you don't know what's what anymore. But we were very clearly a digitally third or a digitally fourth brand. We were never digitally first. And as that sort of took off, I mean, there was only a handful of players that were really, you know, participating in this space. It behooved me to tell you that it was an easy journey. It wasn't. But I think the good thing was that because you had specialists like DSG and then in our angel round, we also had, after the Shripad round, we did one more angel round. We had Fireside Ventures participate. This is before the fund started. We were out of fund zero because fund one came later on. It was the Fireside Trust. And then I think things started moving in motion. So, but you had specialists, and I think as long as they understood and you had the right access or you had their ear, you know, I think Kaval and Deepak were the two who continue to be the two best in the game today. And we were blessed to have both of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So, how did the growth happen? Like, you did 20 crores from, like, rough, whatever you recall in terms of how it grew from 16, 17 to this year.
Yeah, for those few years, we doubled the year upon year. And then last sort of, I mean, this COVID year was obviously a tough one, but we still grew about 30%, 35% in this COVID year as well.
So, I think one major milestone for Epigamia has been the Danone investment. I mean, I personally thought that was like a game changer. Could you tell me about that, how it happened, and do you see it as a game changer?
Yeah, I think game changer may be a strong word, but I think definitely a surprise or a disruption as far as all our mentality was concerned. What was interesting with Danone or Danone, as I called them growing up, was that when we launched Greek yogurt initially in 2015, they were sort of the big enemy. They were the competitor. We actually looked up to them. When I say enemy, I kid, because, obviously they were someone we aspired to sort of look up to and say, this is a company we can learn from. But of course, we want to come in and do something different and disrupt and not do the same old things that everyone's doing. And, on the shelves, whatever it was, I kid and I joke, but, we literally had a dartboard with the image of Danone, and we used to throw darts at it at the office.
Not Nestle. I thought Nestle would be bigger.
They were there too. Although great folks. I mean, even Nestle, amazing people. But it was sort of, so if you sort of rewind the time to 2015, 2016, and, you tell the 2015, 2016 Rohan or Uday or Rahul or Chef Ganesh or anyone on the team or Sid, and you tell them that in 2019 or 2020, or for that matter, 2021, not only is Danone going to be a shareholder, but they're also going to be partners and they're going to be, sort of advisors. We would have all thought you were insane. So for us to come full circle was quite crazy. And, it was interesting because they, obviously that was the sort of, view we had of them. And, sometimes, they always say, don't judge a book by its cover. And I genuinely believe that. And I think, that was our case with Danone. I think, we always looked at them as the big guys and we're the small guys. And, we were introduced to them through one of our investors. And, when we were raising our Series C, again, they were not even in the radar. We had heard that in New York, there was a Danone Ventures that had launched. They'd sort of set up this, a corporate venture capital arm. I mean, we'd heard about it just as you heard about in the news, but there was never any intent or there was never any interaction. There was never any storyline that they were running in Asia for that matter. And that too, they were focused more on America and Europe and things of that nature. And we were introduced to them through one of our investors. And I think the idea at the time, the investors we already had were very keen on, doing Series C without going to the outside market. We thought, okay, let's, talk to one or two that we thought could potentially add value as we keep scaling. So we had one or two conversations and we were actually in the process of closing out one of those conversations. And I actually, I was introduced to the Danone Ventures guys. And, I just said, just for kicks, for giggles, what's the harm in going and meeting? And that was the internal sort of thesis that, never hurts. And I'm one of those people that my door is always open, no matter what, I never close the door. Nothing's crazy to me because I think that's the way I've lived my life as well. And so we went in and I met them and, I met the folks in charge and honestly, I was really blown away by their mission. And, their mission was very clear that, look, we are a big company. We are a big sort of behemoth. But we get it. We get it that the disruptors of tomorrow are these younger startups like you. And we sort of have two options. We can continue to try to do stuff and compete with you in the markets, or we could sort of, band together and treat this as a global sort of ecosystem, which we can plug into and you can, and a company like yours can plug into. And, we get to sort of be close to what you're doing on the disruptive side and we can help you with stuff that you probably, you don't have to be disruptive about everything. You can be disruptive about your brand. You can be disruptive about your product, but do you really need to be disruptive about how a truck operates or you really need to be disruptive about inventory management, right? So you know, these are things that really spoke to me. And then I realized that, you know, here's a company that actually means what they're saying. There was a larger mission behind, you know, what they're trying to do in terms of support and build sustainability globally. And, you know, in fact, this division of theirs, which was Danone Ventures, is actually a B corporation. I don't know if you're familiar with what a B corporation is actually.
No, I'm not familiar.
It's for profit, and it's a certification. It's a global certification. So it's not that it's an NGO of any sorts. Of course, it's a for profit, but it requires a mission, you know, that goes beyond just you know, financial. And you know, and it's you know, there are very few companies out there. Ben & Jerry's is one of them that have that sort of B corporation status. And you know, it spoke volumes to me that this sort of division of theirs had that sort of certification. And I realized that their mission actually was to build out a larger ecosystem, you know, not just sort of learn what the startups are doing and go and do something and replicate it. And I think, you know, in hindsight, your gut has to give you everything. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur, so a lot goes by my gut. And I think that first meeting, it was, you know, as they say, it was sort of love at first sight. And so came back and I, you know, told the team. I obviously talked to the investors. Our investors, who have been our best supporters, were extremely wary. They didn't know if this was the right move. There's a lot of conversation. Does this mean that, you know, we're, you know, selling to a strategic? Is this a partial exit? And I said, you know, let's not think about any of that like that, because the structure of this Danone Ventures is as a fund. I mean, they're like a group within a group. They operate independently, and they have one LP, which is Danone, right, which is giving them their capital, but they're operating like a fund. They have portfolio companies. They're structured just like a VC fund or a private equity fund will be, with a very interesting mission. And, you know, when you've reached sort of the stage we had, you know, to get them to help, we saw as visibility to really take us to the next level from a scale perspective, you know, processes, systems, backend, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, sitting here sort of 2 years later after we raised Series C, which they were sort of, they led along with Verlinvest, I think that was probably the best decision we made at that time.
In what ways did that collaboration benefit you? Like, what in addition to the money? Like,
you know? Absolutely. And I'm happy to share that sort of example and, you know, demonstrate. You know, it's nice. It's nice when you hear it in words, but what does that mean in reality, right? I think that's your question, Akshay.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. I'll tell you what happened is, you know, we were sitting in Mumbai. At one of our board meetings, and there was a discussion around as we were scaling our distribution. Now, this is pre-COVID, so let's sort of rewind a little bit, right? So let's not COVID, of course, we'll talk about as a whole different ballgame. But in pre-COVID, you know, there was a conversation that took place around as we were sort of expanding and scaling our distribution. For us to scale our distribution is, you know, going deeper and deeper into GT and Kirana shops, right? And as we get deeper and deeper into Kirana shops, there's a, you know, there's a lot of efficiency that has to be sort of garnered, because you know, the drop sizes get lower. So for example, the larger modern trade stores or the larger, more, you know, high volume throughput stores, you're dropping off 30, 40, even hundreds of cups at a time every delivery. Now you get to the smaller Kirana shops, and you know, that guy tells you, you know, mujhe 5 chahiye ya 10 chahiye, I want 5 or 10, you know. And there you have to be very efficient, you know, how much time you spend at the store, how much, you know, how you efficiently get in there, take the order, drop the delivery, come back, how you plan your truck, how you plan the operations, how you, when you load the truck, you know, basic sort of supply chain logistics hygiene, right? But when you say, yes, basic, but also very, very specific to cold chain and to yogurt, right? And now at that point, we had started with multiple products. So we had yogurt, we had smoothies, we had a whole bunch of things. There's a and now also, mind you, you're doing it in an environment where a lot of times the, you know, dukanwala will turn the fridge off at night, and there's all these other challenges you have, right? So we were discussing our plan and our go-to-market strategy on how we're going to be building out our distribution. And, you know, one of the guys from Danone Ventures who was there said, you know, what we're doing, what Epigamia is doing right now in Mumbai is very similar to what, you know, our team in Egypt did 10 years ago. And we said, oh, really? That's interesting. And, you know, and they said, well, so I said, let's talk more. And so they said, you know, you should talk to them, because they built their own distribution. It's Egypt is even more a Kirana shop market than India. It's all about, you know, the global word for Kirana is mom and pop shop, right? That's how we sort of refer to it. And, you know, there is no modern trade. They're very restricted modern trade. And it's very similar, very hot country. in Cairo is very warm, very disorganized trade. And they joke, they said, not only do they shut off the refrigerator at night, they actually turn off the electricity because they want to save on all costs. And, you know, so we said, okay, you know, we'll be great. Maybe there's something here to learn from. So we got on the call. We were connected with the team in Egypt. We got on a call with the CEO there, and we had a chat with him. And, you know, we said, hey, listen, you know, these are some questions we had. And, you know, without going into too much detail, but, you know, go to market and route to market, and how do you sort of plan, and how do you do the supply chain? And you know what their answer was? Their answer was, look, be happy to tell you, but why don't you just come here and see it for yourself? You know, and this is, you know, and they have a pretty sizable operation there. They've built it from scratch. It's a 15, 20 year old operation. And we were like, really? And they said, yeah, you know, why don't you come? So the four or five of us, myself included, of course, we all, you know, went a day early to go see the pyramids that we couldn't see. And it helped that Egypt has a nonstop flight from Mumbai. So we went. And not only were they welcoming and receptive, they let us sit on the trucks with them. We went to the market with them. We went to see their manufacturing. We saw how they loaded the truck. And I'm not saying that this is not something we couldn't have done. I think over the course of time, we would have learned how to do it. But we probably saved a good year, year and a half, just by watching how to do it and then implementing it in our backend. So, you know, I think that served as a great example of the collaboration, you know, that they've sort of, it's not just them being there. And I mean, they really meant it when they said, we're going to let you plug into the ecosystem. And I think that just helps us focus on what we're good at and, you know, helps continuing. And now, of course, there's a lot of other conversations, you know, of course, there's a lot of stuff they cannot disclose, which is because we are two independent companies, but wherever they feel it's okay and it warrants, you know, some form of collaboration, they've been more than happy to sort of support and push for it.
Okay. So are you looking at going global and, you know, kind of piggybacking on their global presence?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's every entrepreneur's dream. I think, you know, had you asked me this question even 6 or 7 months ago, I would have said, you know, it's in the cards and it continues to be in the cards. But I think, you know, we believe that, you know, the Made in India stamp is going to get more and more potent and powerful as things go forward. I mean, we're seeing now, the world is seeing now that, you know, Made in India can equate to quality if done the right way. Of course, we've believed it for a very long time. So at least, you know, neighboring markets, you know, in the next sort of 8 to 12 months, we will start exploring. But it won't be a focus for us. I think right now we're still very determined. We have a lot to do in India. I mean, we just touched the iceberg. I think those will be more opportunistic, you know, expansions. But yes, a few years from now, you know, certainly that'll be a play for us.
So what's going to be your focus? Is it going to be like to go down into tier two, tier three, or expand product range, or like, you know, what is it that you're going to focus on to grow the brand and the revenue?
Yeah, so for us, it's two very clear-cut strategies, right? It's the you know, continue sort of disrupting the product portfolio, continue launching new products, you know, all the way from sort of premium, and now we're looking at more sort of accessible value products that are in the 20 to 25 rupee, potentially even next year, a 15 rupee price point. When I say accessible, I don't mean compromise on quality, supremely high-quality products, but, you know, giving a little bit more accessibility and generating trials so people can start moving their way up to a 30 and a 40 rupee product eventually. And that's something that we're very focused on. And then secondly, just continue to expand distribution. I mean, today, if you look at where our market sort of size is in India, we're looking at, you know, we're not looking at 1 billion people, right? That's not who we're speaking to. We're speaking to about 60 to 80 million people in the country. That's who we see, sort of the middle class and the upper middle class. And if you look at our penetration, we're not even 2 million people today. So we have a very, very long way to go. So, you know, 30X is in the cards for us. And hopefully we can get there much faster, sooner than later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, amazing. So my last question to you, how is working in India and doing business in India different from the way things happen in the US? Like, you know, what are some of the quirks that you saw, or the unique challenges or unique opportunities that you experienced?
Without having any of my friends and my family and my coworkers yell and scream for these comments, we're getting torn. I think you know, there's this.
And I don't want a politically correct answer. I want like a frank, honest opinion. I mean, we all know who we are, what our shortcomings are. You know, I don't think. I don't think there are too many Modi bhakts who listen to my podcast. So.
No, I think without being trolled, I think, I will give you the political answer as well, but let me give you the honest, cold, honest truth first. I think the reality is that, coming from this environment, we're coming from sort of the American environment. I mean, there was definitely a certain level of timeliness. I think I don't want to use the word professionalism because I see there's a lot of professionalism, and I'm very proud of the organization we have and how we operate. But I think there was just a certain, value for time or timeliness that is associated. And I come from New York City, where traffic is worse than Bombay. So when meetings are not happening and it's being blamed on traffic, I don't buy it because New York is like that. And when someone's telling you they're going to come on Monday and they don't even show up or give you a phone call, and then they come on Tuesday, and I think and I'd also have to say even when we were sort of building the business early on, just sort of being dismissed. Where is this company going to go? And, some of the sort of the more traditional business vendors, I won't take names, but, just not even entertaining our conversations because I'm not saying that they should have. I mean, I think a discussion would have been warranted, at least hear us out. But now that we're of volume and size, now they're willing to give us any discounted price we want. And I'm not saying that's a difference between, maybe the Western world or India, but I think it would have just... maybe the decision making would have been similar. They wouldn't have taken us on then, but taken us on later. But I think a conversation would have been warranted or merited. So I think a lot of that takes place. Of course, you deal with the infrastructural issues. But Akshay, that being said, I think one of the things that sort of helped us, and again, I'm not trying to make this a political answer, but I think I sort of, because of some of the exposure I had to India, visiting India a few times, and because of some of the stuff I told you earlier, being sort of advised by family, friends that you're out of your mind, you're crazy for going there. I think the bar was already so low for me that I came with zero preconceived notions. So when I came, I anticipated that there's no such thing as having a plan A and a plan B. You better, buddy, have a plan C, D, and an E, right? This is not a plan A, plan B country. There better be C, D, and E, and you better be ready for all of those. And I think, to be honest, sort of maybe there's a sense of naivety that was in there. When things went a certain way, I wouldn't get surprised. I wouldn't complain. When internet stopped working in the middle of a conference call or an email, I wouldn't blow my lid. I just treated it as normal practice. Now, that being said, things have changed insanely in the last 6-7 years. I mean, just the speed we have is obscene of internet or whatever it is. But I think that sort of helped a little bit, I would say. I think for me, it became an asset. Because I wouldn't let those things bog me down, I'm not, brutally honest here. I've got a lot of friends and peers and people I know that came from the United States, from other countries outside of India, and came with these preconceived notions, and then sort of blame that as a reason why their ventures didn't take off. And I think, frankly, that's hogwash. Those are not reasons why your venture doesn't take off, because the internet doesn't work or because people are stuck in traffic. Give me a break. So I think, or because someone didn't take a meeting. So, go back 15 times, fry the guy to death to take the meeting. I think these are things that you have to sort of do. And so I think what was maybe sort of going into it saying, okay, this is a liability, I think it ended up being an asset for me because I didn't see it in that way.
Wow, amazing. Cool. So thank you so much for your time. Any last words to people who are aspiring to build their own brands?
Yeah, I mean, my advice always is if you're on the fence, don't do it. you have to be all in or all out. There's nothing in between. Yes, you may need some time to build a plan and do stuff and, get yourself financially ready. But, 6-8 months is good enough. Post that. If you're not ready to take it on, you're never going to be ready. Don't waste your time. Don't do disservice to your own self, to your potential venture, or to your current employer. It's just not worth it.
So if that conversation left you craving for some Greek yogurt, then check out the exciting flavors of Epigamia that are available for home delivery on epigamia.com, amazon.in, or the Big Basket app.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.